Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and we are continuing to talk to Division I head coaches as we ramp up to September 1st in order to learn a little bit more about how they go about their process of recruiting. Really excited for this conversation. Welcome in High Point head coach John Torpy. Coach Torpy, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
So I interviewed three of your peers and then shifted format a little bit in speaking with Coach Andy Shea last week and went from being a little bit more like rigid, talking about evaluation and then talking about communication, and changed it up and went with more of a timeline format. And I like it, and I'm going to stick with it. And I'm going to start even earlier with you, because I think that there's a lot about where you were before you ended up in High Point, North Carolina, that is important to understand relative to how you go about this process. So let's take it all the way back to Baltimore. You went to Calvert Hall. It is the bluest of blue bloods, the hottest of hotbeds. And yet, I don't think you're necessarily like the typical 2023 Calvert Hall recruit. Tell me a little bit about your background, what it was like being a Cardinal, and how that experience informed the man you are today.
Yeah, Calvert Hall, I love that place. And I was fortunate enough to do like a leadership talk for them a couple of years ago and kind of went back in time and, you know, think about just everything from, you know, how much of a melting pot the place is to, you know, how socioeconomically diverse the school is to, you know, just everything and anything about it. I loved it. I was fortunate enough to play for Brian Kelly there. And, you know, I always say, like, I'm not your typical lacrosse guy from Baltimore, because my parents didn't, you know, play or weren't from that area. My mom's from Manhattan, my dad's from Jersey City. And so I stumbled upon the sport a little bit later than most guys that were at the school. And then from Calvert Hall, was fortunate enough to go to Ohio State. And then literally since then, I've hit, you know, almost as far west as you could go, being at the University of Denver, spent some time in Division III at Goucher and Denison. And, you know, was fortunate to be about as north as you could get at Dartmouth. And now it's this the opposite extreme down here at High Point. So been able to, you know, formulate a lot of great relationships over the years and some and really cool, like, geographical spots. It's given us a lot of diversity in our locker room.
And you scratched the surface of where I wanted to go next, because it's not just about the geography, although that is, you know, important and very interesting. It's also about the type of program that you are part of. And again, the Ohio State program that you were part of is not the Ohio State program that exists now in terms of early in Joe Brescia's tenure. Certainly, like, I don't want to say, I guess let me ask it as opposed to stating it. Where was the program in that transition from essentially, like, you know, varsity, but still having elements of like just a well-organized and structured club team into being like a, you know, Power Five kind of BCS program that it is now? And also can't help but remind folks that you were a captain when you were a sophomore. So you were a part of that, leading that transition.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always like tiptoe into this because some of the guys that were there before me are some of the best leaders, some of the best friends I had. And, you know, wasn't fully supported. You know, there was a lot of transition going on my freshman year for sure and the years before that. But I think having Coach Brescia come in, just like him coming in, like, really legitimized the place. And, you know, from that point forward, the schedule, the support, like all the things that we needed to be a successful program at that time were kind of given to us. And to be a part of that transition where it went from, you know, maybe not fully supported to seeing it be fully supported from a scholarship perspective, funding, all those different things, you know, always kind of like, you know, kind of excited me about being somewhere new and being able to do something different. And I didn't know till I got here at High Point that, you know, I just loved building things from scratch, you know, because everything to that point forward, outside of maybe the transition from what you just said at Ohio State, my freshman to sophomore year, was going somewhere where something was already seemed to be established at a pretty high level. So just to be able to be there, be part of the foundation, you know, be a captain, like you said, as a sophomore, and have some, you know, sweat equity in the thing with the other guys that were there and with the coaching staff, was a really special time, and to see what that thing has become now is remarkable. I mean, the stadium opening up last year and having all of our, you know, alumni friends and everybody be a part of that, and to see what Nick's doing, and, you know, to just know that Ohio State lacrosse has played in a national championship game. I mean, it's really cool to know you're a part of something like that.
So you mentioned that you made a couple stops at Division III and then you got back into Division I at Denver. And, you know, I think that they were probably a little bit farther along in that journey of supporting the program and developing into the winning program that it turned into while you were there and after you departed. But at the same time, you know, when we start talking about the Panthers, there's a heavy Canadian flair, both Ontario and British Columbia. And I'm sure that, you know, that was a big part of your time and tenure, not just coaching the Pios, but also through your playing experience, longtime NLL and MLL player as well. What did you learn while you were at Denver, and how has it informed your perspective on recruiting in the intervening years?
Well, I think, you know, being a part of Jamie's staff, Jamie is one of the best.
Jamie Monroe, who was head coach
Jamie
at the time.
Jamie Monroe, yeah. Jamie's one of the best, you know, developers of skill that I've ever been around, offensively and defensively. And just the conversations that we would have in the office, you know, going out on the field after practice, working through things. I mean, he's as good as they get in that realm. And so it was a lot of that. It was a lot of like the skill development piece. You know, before that, it was more so like strategies on the field and things of that sort. But he really like broke down like how to take a guy from point A to point B in the development piece. And then being at Denver was just incredible because you got a chance to still recruit. We really like heavily recruited, obviously, Canada. The Founders League was big for us up there. You know, because of where I was from, I always wanted to see if we could get some Baltimore, D.C., some, you know, Philly guys on the roster. But it really forced us to find guys that were, I mean, all over the map. I mean, we were going to California before people were going to California. We were going to Texas to watch high school football games. Watching guys like Matt Stafford play in high school and, you know, seeing guys play at that level was incredible. And it started to, like, build this thought process in my mind where it's like, if you can get a great high school football player from Ohio and you can get a great athlete who plays maybe two sports from Texas, you were getting 50, maybe 33% of the version of that guy, you know, who was going to be coming into a program playing lacrosse for the first time full year, you know, for a full year. It was like, man, this is going to be really cool to see how good this kid can get and where we can get this skill set and, you know, how we can start to build on this kid's IQ game-wise. And a lot of that just came from Jamie's, you know, love, I guess, kind of coming from that Dom Starza tree of just falling in love with, like, elite-level athletes, you know, and knowing that if those guys could figure out what some of the guys that were coming from the more traditional hotbed areas could do once they started to play lacrosse full-time, you know, you were gonna get a really high level player, and we really did. I mean, it was a perfect blend of really good players from traditional areas and some, you know, unconventional recruits from some non-traditional areas that were great athletes. And then you mix the Canadians in on that. And at that time, we were doing so much development between the field and the two boxes that we had in the Ritchie Center at the University of Denver, having Matt Brown on staff. You know, all those things came together. And it was really fun to see that transformation out there.
And then lastly, to round out your experience, your final stop before taking over at High Point was at Dartmouth. And you mentioned, obviously, I think it's the northernmost Division I men's program. And if it's not, then I need to brush up on my geography. But it's also, you're dealing with an Ivy League institution that has, you know, a tremendous alumni base, as well as really important, and as we talked about with Andy Shea, at times difficult to manage admission standards. What did you learn from that stop?
I think the biggest thing I learned is, like, I always was blown away with how much the players loved Andy Towers. I mean, I always say, like, that was one of the most fun staffs I've ever been a part of, with Andy and Ryan. And I think the number one thing I learned up there, and up until that point in my career, my main focus was help these guys become better people, make sure these guys do what they need to do academically, and then try to do your best to develop them into the best lacrosse player you can possibly make them. But I think the biggest thing I learned from Dartmouth that I've taken down here is Andy's willingness to help guys get their first internship opportunities and job opportunities through that program opened my eyes to something that was less about building, you know, your time during those 4 years. And it was more about like you investing in that kid's life. And I've watched every single one of our guys at High Point, you know, for the most part, get their first internship and job opportunity through either former players, parents, friends of our program, but through our program. And we celebrate those things like their wins. And so when the guys get those at these companies that maybe, you know, a non-Ivy League guy or a non, you know, high-end top 25 academic institution wouldn't normally get, has been probably the most rewarding thing outside of seeing them get married and have kids and, you know, be successful beyond their years here. But I mean, I never forget the first time that we faxed an offer sheet for one of our guys to Goldman Sachs at Dartmouth, and just the way Andy like celebrated that and the way Ryan celebrated that, I was like, this is like the coolest thing I've ever been a part of. You know, to watch that kid know that he was going to be making more than probably our entire staff in his first year, and to see what that, you know, what that did for our relationship beyond, you know, what I ended up finding out the 4 years that they were there was just terrific. I mean, and I love Dartmouth. I mean, I'd never lived in a house that wasn't attached to another house or an apartment before then. Wasn't ready for the great Northeast, but it was just such a phenomenal time in my life.
It's a really, I'm glad you shared that anecdote. And I just wanted to reinforce how legitimate what you just said is, because I actually was in a High Point locker room the day that you informed all, I can't recall which player it was, but he got a job, he accepted an offer that day, and I was there to watch practice that night, and I was in the locker room when you told the rest of his teammates that he had just accepted that offer, or you gave him the floor so that he could say it himself. And and you're right, that's what the celebration looked like. It looked like what you would look like, what a celebration looks like after a win. It was incredible.
Yeah, it was awesome.
So with all that as foundation, you have an opportunity to become the first head coach in a new program's history. Obviously, there's a blank canvas and you can attack it any number of ways. And there have been hundreds of players who have come through your program over the course of the last 10 or 11 years. And we're not going to have time to talk about all of them. I've picked out five that I want to drill down on because I think they represent examples of your approach, of some of the things that you've already touched on, as well as some of the things that make High Point unique and its conditions unique as well. So feel free to evoke anecdotes or stories or bring in examples of other players that I don't bring up. But I want to start with Matt Thistle and Dan Lomas, because to me it's remarkable that you had sophomore and freshman starters at Attack that were basically your leading scorers for the entirety of the time that they were on campus. How did you get those two guys? How did they represent the recruiting that you started in terms of how you wanted to build the program from scratch?
Yeah, wow, that's pretty cool going back and talking about those guys. Well, I'll talk about Dan first. So Pat Tracy, my assistant at the time, had seen Dan play at, I think it was the All-Canada events when it was still not really as well attended as it is now. And he said, there's a kid up here. We got to take a look at. He's really good. And based on what worked for us at the University of Denver, we started to like make this formula of different positions we needed every year, you know, positions that we couldn't afford not to take on a given year. And a lefty Canadian was one of those positions, you know. And if you look at the lineage of guys that were at the University of Denver during my tenure there, there's some of the best guys that have played in the last, you know, probably 15, 20 years. And so we wanted that to be a centerpiece of our offense with a guy at X who could put a ton of pressure, you know, from behind the goal in a condensed area that was quick enough or big enough to post up. And so Dan became a guy that Pat said, you got to take a look at this guy. I got a chance to go up to see him play in Burlington. We fell in love with him, brought him down here. And we just knew right away, man, with his family, with his demeanor, with his work ethic, that right away he would be our best player. And we knew that our best player needed to be our hardest worker and our best guy and a high character guy and a guy that everybody else could look up to. And that's what Dan did for us. And he did that for 4 years. And, you know, to be in a new program, to, you know, play your first year and do what he did, and then to be an All-American your sophomore, junior, and senior year with a program that has, you know, no history was like nothing short of remarkable. And he's still playing to this day. And then with Matt, I didn't know him at all. Timmy McEntee was leaving Manhattan, and he said, there's a guy that we have on our team that is excellent. He can break down anybody at X. He's got unbelievable vision, and he scored two goals and four assists against Princeton that year. And I forget who the defenseman was. This will be able to tell you in 2 seconds. But I said, man, he did that against him. And then he had sent that film. And this is, again, like predates the transfer portal. You know, he had gotten his release, all these different things. And we brought him down to campus. And I just knew if we could get both of those guys playing together, we'd have something similar to what we had at the University of Denver when I left there, which was Alex Demopoulos being kind of an X guy, more of a post-up guy, playing with a guy like Mark Matthews, you know, who could finish everything and anything inside. So those guys, and I'm telling you, they were best friends. They, you know, total opposites of one another. I mean, in terms of their personalities, but funny as all get out. And I was actually able to see those guys at one of our original guy, Brendan Montrello's wedding a couple months ago. And just exactly the same guys as they were when they were here. And it's really cool to see both of them just dominating life right now.
A couple of years later, you committed a player named Connor McKeamy, and he's become a foundational piece of your program, including the fact that you are wearing a sweatshirt right now that says Mac Mentality. What was his recruiting story like?
Yeah, so a former associate athletic director came into my office, and it was like, I don't want to say this the wrong way, but he was like a slower talking, like Southern guy. And he would come in and he'd sit there for like an hour. And I'm like, man, I got to build a program from scratch. I don't have any recruits yet. Like, I don't know if I could talk to you for this long, but a really good guy. And he said, you know, you got to read this magazine. It was the magazine that featured Connor after the accident. And it was kind of him coming back to the sport of lacrosse. And so I pushed the magazine aside. And one day I decided to pick the thing up and read it. And at the very end of the article, it says, my dream is to play lacrosse at High Point. And I'm like, oh my God, we don't even have a team. We don't have guys committed yet. We don't have a locker room. We don't have anything. And I was like blown away with the guys, probably an NCAA violation, but I called him up and I said, you got to get up here, man. I got to meet you. You know, and I sat down with him and his grandfather for about 2 hours. And I said, listen, like, I don't know if we're ever going to get you the opportunity to play here, you know, because I've never seen you play. But if you want to come up here and fill some sort of role in our team, I'd be honored. And it was almost like immediate on the spot. He was like, that would be really cool. And so he came up and was our manager for the first 2 years he was in school. And then you could tell, I mean, his mom always says he's like a Labrador retriever. Like you roll a ball out and he just wants to chase it. He just loves being around sports. And he was itching to play. So he came into my office and he said, Coach, it's been great being a manager here. It's been, you know, an unbelievable 2 years of my life. But my goal is to be on a team. And so I said, listen, I'll let you be on the team. We'll have to go through some different channels and make sure medically it's okay. And he did those things. And then I said, and then you got to ask the guys on the team, you know, if they're willing to accept you, you know, knowing that you'd be joining almost mid-year. And so he did that. And same thing. The guys erupted. They loved it. So he was a manager for 2 years, played for us for 2 years, was just did a phenomenal job, ended up scoring like 3 points in his first ever scrimmage, unbelievably high IQ guy, knows everything about the sport. And then he worked on staff here for, you know, about 5 years. So our relationship, you know, predates the program. It's about 13, 14 years old. And then to look what he's doing now with the publishing of the book this summer and going on this like national and world speaking tour. I couldn't be prouder of him. And he's just such an unbelievable human being. I mean, it's a plug for him, but if any team's looking for somebody that can talk on adversity and, you know, dealing with, you know, being in a different circumstance and fighting through some things, he's a great guy to bring on board just for, you know, for an afternoon.
You had great goalie play from the jump, thanks to Austin Geisler, who transferred in from UVA. But then you transitioned into a very fortunate situation of essentially having great goalie play for about 7 years, because shortly on the heels of Austin's graduation, you added Tim Trautner. How did you find and when did you commit Tim Trautner?
Yeah, that's a great story. So Mike Phipps was on my staff at the time. He's now the offensive coordinator at Navy. And he said, there's a guy from Annapolis, and the Annapolis guys, they love Annapolis guys, you know? And I said, all right, cool. Take a look. And Timmy had been the starter at St. Mary's. And I liked him, but there were some like fundamental flaws, you know, in his game, that I felt like needed to be fixed. And so I think Timmy ended up like coming down here at one point. It's when you could early recruit. We kind of said, you know, we want to see you play a little bit more. This happens with a lot of our guys because we don't get like the 1% guys. Then he came to like two of our prospect camps, and I'm just like, I don't know. I just don't see it. And in the interim, we had committed another goalie from Delbarton who ended up decommitting. And so we were kind of in this position late Timmy's senior year. We were still looking for a guy. And so I go to the MIA championship game, and I said to Timmy, like, we're going to make our decision like this night. Right. It was May 15th, MIA championship game, St. Mary's at Hopkins. He stands on his head. I call him, and he's on the bus ride back to St. Mary's after they had just won the MIA championship. And Timmy committed to us in May of his senior year in high school. So I always say, like, I always joke at our prospect camps, like when you talk about, you know, recruiting, like we are, it's never an exact science. And we screwed that one up probably three times before we ended up getting one of the best goalies that I've ever had the fortune to be around.
So you touched on something there that I want to dive a little bit deeper on. I think these issues are kind of conjoined. One of the elements of it's kind of the blessing and the curse of your position and how good you are at identifying good players is you take a lot of commits, and then in many instances that kind of raises the alarm for other programs. They're like, oh, if High Point's interested in him, we need to take another look at him. And one of the elements of your approach is essentially trying to maintain those commitments until guys end up on campus. How do you balance the challenge? You want to get the best players possible, but you also know that your program is a target for folks to continue to recruit your committed players. So you want to get the best players possible, and then you have to continue to recruit them in order to make sure that they make it to campus. How do you regard that challenge?
Yeah, I guess it doesn't really change a whole lot. I mean, we still go after the best guys we think we've got a shot at. And we have. We've lost a lot of guys over the years, you know, and it comes down to the point where I think early on it was more about the sell. You know, we're selling High Point. You were, I wouldn't say begging guys to come here, but maybe there weren't a whole lot of things that had happened at that point. You know, maybe we haven't played certain teams or won certain games or, you know, had our guys getting into the workforce and things of that sort that we could explain to them. And so I felt like, and I still do, I feel like every time we have to sell and almost beg to get a guy here, and it's not a guy who comes down here and visits and is like just running through the door to come in, we end up doing and having that process be something that happens through the recruiting process, through the freshman year, almost through the 4 years now with the portal. So I guess the biggest shift has just been not going the sales route and just kind of explaining to them like all the things that are going to happen here, both good and bad, and then being as authentic as we possibly can, and then knowing that they're going to meet these other guys in the locker room that are going to do the exact same thing. And fortunately, we haven't lost a whole lot of guys, but I also think that's a byproduct of, you know, the COVID fifth years. I think, you know, coaches' attention have gone more towards those guys, the schools that would typically, you know, go after our recruits. But I could see it opening back up now that, you know, the COVID fifth year with the Division I is going to be over after 2024. So, you know, it's, I don't want to say it's an unfortunate position. It's just kind of the nature of the beast. We've had to go after some guys at other schools. Guys have gone after our guys, and it's just the way the game is played now. So, we've dealt with it, and we've lost some guys, but we've also gotten some guys. And I think for us, we know once guys get here in the locker room and the guys in there put their arms around a guy and say, like, you know, you're one of us now, like, it's tough for guys to leave, you know. So we try to create as many times during the year where we get you know, our recruits like touch points with our current players, whether it's an unofficial visit or, hey, come down to a practice, whatever that might be.
How does it inform how many players you try to bring in a class? This is a conversation that you and I have had over the last decade, and it's changed by virtue of, among other things, injury rates, right? And, you know, you've talked about how an outsider might look at our roster and say, it's a really big roster. But until they look at our injury report on a day-to-day basis in the fall and in the spring and see that there are 11 guys that are unavailable due to either ACL recovery or broken thumb or soft tissue injury, they don't realize how quickly we can go from what would appear to be a big roster to a roster that's actually limited in terms of what it can do in practice. So from that standpoint, anything else, how many players do you try to bring in a typical class year, and what is the rationale behind those choices?
Yeah, we try to bring in, anywhere from like 15 to 20 guys, depending upon what the class above them that's graduating looks like. And it's also, you know, what the attrition rate looks like amongst the team. I mean, that's the one thing I think people don't look at a whole lot. And, you know, because of who we are and because we're not going to be, for a lot of guys, like the first pick when they go in the portal, we always feel like, you know, our best decision is going to be to bring freshmen in and try to develop them from freshman to senior year. So for us, man, we do these player-driven depth charts in the fall where our guys will kind of vote on where they think other guys on the team or where they fit in. And the amount of guys that came in that were literally like the lowest guy on the depth chart, like Timmy Troutner and Dalton Solver is playing with the Buffalo Bandits right now, that ended up being number one by the time they were seniors, tells us like, all right, we might not be getting five-star recruits. We might not be getting a four-star recruit every year, you know, but we can be five-star developers. We can be five-star recruiters in terms of like where we're going to go geographically and how far out we're going to find a guy. And if we bring him in and they kind of follow the rules of our program on and off the field, and they kind of work through this system of development where, you know, you start at like a five, you drop to a one, two, a couple weeks in, and then you start building back up, then we feel like we can, you know, we can help those guys get to where they want to be. And I, again, like you said, we've got 12 guys right now to start the season that had season-ending injuries last year, whether it was broken bones, whether it was ACL, whether it was a back injury, you know. So for us, like, you know, I have this nightmare, you know, that happens probably twice a semester where I wake up in the middle of the night and I look at the bench and there's nobody there, you know, there's nobody to go to. And, I've been in that position before. I don't want to be in that position. And I think our guys know that, yeah, we're going to have a little bit of a bigger roster, but you're always going to be able to come in this office. The door is always going to be open. You're always going to get, you know, a great amount of reps in practice. You know, we've done a really good job of devising schemes and ways to play a lot of guys. And, you know, I think our guys actually like it. I mean, I think our guys like having some different guys in there, and they, you know, I think the most difficult part is just getting that whole group to move in the same direction. And that takes a little bit of time, takes a little bit of communication, takes a little bit of trust. And, you know, fortunately for us, we've been able to figure out how to do that the last couple of years.
One 4-star who should have been a 5-star in retrospect that you did get is Asher Nolting. And I remember he and T.D. Erland stick out in my memory as guys that we had significant conversations about selecting for what was at the time the Under Armour All-American game, and went a different direction and lived to regret it. How did you find Asher Nolting, and what was his recruiting story like?
Yeah, that's another one, another late one. But at the time, he was committed to Air Force. And Jamie Monroe, again, was out there, and he said, this kid going to Air Force is unbelievable, and started to hear some things that he might not be, you know, 100% excited about going there at the rate that he was when he committed, because he committed so early. Again, that was before, you know, what the rules are in place now with September 1 of the junior year. And I, you know, reached out to Eric Saramed, who I would consider a great friend and someone that was a mentor to me when I was out at Denver. He was at Air Force and he was the head coach at the time. And I said, listen, you know, I don't know the right way to do this, because it was not, it wasn't as commonplace as it is now. But I said, I've heard some things about this kid Asher Nolting, you know, maybe not wanting to go there. So we're going to reach out to him. And, you know, Saramed's like, oh, is that the way things work now? And then, you know, we joked on text a couple of times, because they had Air Force had taken one of our guys, you know, 2 years earlier. And we ended up having a conversation with him and getting him to come out here on an official visit. Okay. So he comes out on an official visit with Eric Peters. And Eric Peters was committed to us at the time. And he was a goalie that ended up starting, I think, 3, maybe 4 years at Princeton. And Eric's, you know, heart selling Asher with us. And we feel like, man, this could be a great thing. And the next thing you know, Eric decommits, goes to Princeton, Asher commits. And Asher, again, he committed in April of his senior year in high school. I mean, so here's a guy right now that's arguably the best player in the world based on, I mean, he's leading the PLL in points. And he's a guy that literally committed to us, like Timmy, you know, in the deepest, darkest hour of his senior year. And I mean, I fell in love with Asher, just like I fell in love with Timmy when, you know, we ended up going to that MIA championship game and really getting to know them. And Asher was one of those guys that I got a chance to see play. And it was like, damn, this guy could be our quarterback. This guy could rides like nobody I've ever seen before. And if you've ever had a conversation with him, he's like an encyclopedia of sports. I mean, it's remarkable. I mean, you could ask him who scored 17.5 points in, you know, game 3 of the 1985 NBA Finals, and he'll probably give you the answer. And from a lacrosse IQ perspective and how much he cared about the game, we had no kind of doubt in our mind that early on we wanted to do what Mike Krzyzewski did with Bobby Hurley. It was like, you give him the ball and you let him run the offense. You know, and I remember like talking to you and everything about Asher going into the PLL draft was, man, his turnovers. And I said to you, I said, we let him play with the ball in his possession for 70, 75, 80% of a possession. So his turnovers become our team's turnovers. And with that, you know, we live and die by the decisions that he makes. And for, you know, the 5 years that he was here, I mean, the majority of the decisions that he made were elite as anybody I've ever seen on the lacrosse field out here.
For those that haven't checked the PLL stats recently, and I haven't checked since this last weekend's games, but I do know that after the first 8 games of the season, Asher was not only leading the league in scoring, but also averaging a paltry 1.4 turnovers per game. So there's a lot of vindication in that number right there, JT.
No doubt, man. No doubt.
So let's transition to talking about the class of 25. But actually, you know what? Let's not. Let's start by talking about the class of 24. Where are you on your 24s? How many do you have, and how many more do you feel like you're going to end up taking?
Yeah, we've got 18 guys. We feel like, again, we're not putting like a number on it because we're going to graduate 25 guys in our senior class because our senior class is made up of true fourth-year seniors. And we have 9 fifth-year seniors that came back. And the reason, I think, again, why our numbers are a little high is the university, High Point, said to anybody that was here during 2020 that we'll pay for your communications business leadership master's your fifth year. We'll pay for the tuition if you pay for room and board. So I tell my guys all the time, man, I went to college 26 years ago, never left. Like, I've never heard anybody say, I wish I left college early. So we've left the door open for every one of our guys to come back. And with that, you know, we've had, you know, a little bit bigger roster size. So our senior class graduating, we'll try to replace those guys. We lost a couple guys in the summer to the transfer portal, just kind of natural attrition of a program, 2 or 3 guys. And so we're going to continue to recruit the 24 class probably until the same time we made decisions on Timmy and Asher. We'd be foolish not to. And I think, again, while I truly believe that every guy that's verbally committed to us now is going to, you know, sign their commitment letters in November, we're taking into account the fact that because the COVID fifth year is over, we could be in a situation in a month or two where we start finding out some of those guys are going other places. Now, I hope that doesn't happen, but in a real world, you know, we can always kind of bank on maybe losing 1 or 2 guys. So we've still got 24s visiting, you know, when we're allowed to get those guys back on campus in September. We'll still be evaluating those guys. And again, like, part of the thing that happened when I was at the University of Denver, I thought Jamie did a great job of, was he was in such great communication with, you know, some of the high-end academic schools where all of a sudden a kid finds out he's not getting in somewhere. We want to make sure that, you know, we have opportunities and spots available for some of these high-end guys and maybe a portal guy, that kind of thing. So we're still in the midst of it.
How does that inform, and what is your kind of day of strategy for September 1st with the class of 25?
Yeah, I mean, we looked at it the other day, right? And Kenny Brochard, my assistant, does an unbelievable job of like recruiting the class ahead of the one that we can actually talk to. So he goes to all the big showcase events. We try to get those guys to prospect days. He's going to team camps where I might be more so like doing the victory lap, watching some of our committed 24s. He might be doing a little bit more 25s. So as the summer kind of gets into July, after we get through that dead period, I'll start looking at a lot more 25s and watching some of the guys Kenny's watched. This summer with, you know, Coach Tuma leaving to go to Ohio State and us not picking up Coach Shakey and Coach Logan playing in the PLL was really just myself and Kenny until Coach Shakey got on board in July after the dead period. So of the guys that myself and Kenny have seen through these showcases and team camps and prospect camps, we probably have a list of like 450 guys right now. That we've identified as one of three things, an A+, an A, or a B+. And this is a formula that Andy put together when we were at Dartmouth. The A+s are like the 1% guys. You know, they're the guys with stars in front of their names. They're the guys that are, you can kind of look at, and right now they're exactly probably, you know, the version of themselves that you know you're going to get. They're legit players, and there's not a whole lot of surprise with those guys. The A's are guys that we think are really good, but, you know, maybe missing something. Maybe they're a two-sport athlete. You know, maybe, you know, we think they could be like an all-conference caliber player, maybe a starter for us, but kind of need to see more. And then the B+s are guys we haven't seen a whole lot of. Maybe they've sent us a highlight film. Maybe we've kind of been introduced to them by that. Maybe we haven't seen them live. Or maybe they're like normal bloomers or like late bloomers, or like we got to, you know, see them develop a little bit more. So I'd say we probably have probably close to 70 guys that will text and call on September 1. And I think this week we're going to try to start to see if we can knock some guys off of that list that are like the A+s that we legitimately probably don't have a shot at getting. You know, maybe they're Ivy League. Maybe they're more looking towards Power Fives. You know, maybe there's a connection that they have with another school with a brother playing there or something like that. But the majority of guys we get, we'll get maybe, you know, a handful of A+s every year, those 1% guys, but the majority of guys are going to be in that A category. And then the B+ category, again, this is where, like, doing this for 24 years, I still don't know how it works. You know, I still don't have an exact formula for it. So we're going to have those guys. Those are the guys that, you know, are like in the 24 class right now that won't commit to us probably until, you know, this spring or maybe the winter.
So kind of building off that, when so much about the last 35 minutes have been about how you value relationships, and there's, you know, a binary between evaluating a player that you can't have communication with versus one that you can have communication with. And the distinction obviously is, now I get to know this individual. I get to know, like, does he share our values? Do I think he's going to work hard? Do I think that our roster is going to like him? How do you approach trying to get to know a 16 or a 17 year old in what is typically a pretty artificial environment, realizing that it's kind of like speed dating in the way that you tend not to be the only person talking to them. And yet, like, you have to independently evaluate all the things that matter to you.
Yeah. I mean, like any coach, right? We can pull up to a field just like you can and know right away who the guys are that stand out. You know, the size, the speed, the skill, the athleticism, what kind of motor a kid has. I mean, those things, you know, their competitiveness for the most part, depending upon when you're seeing them, those things just stand out, right? And then for us, you know, and this is something I got from Andy Shea, man, who's been a great mentor of mine and a great friend. And I remember asking him a couple of years ago, how have you done what you've done at Yale? And he said, we just recruit the best parents in the world. And I'm thinking, like, cliche, like, really, come on now, like, is this really what you do? But you think about it, you're sitting there, you're having a kid on campus, and you need people to help support whether you like him or you don't like him from a character perspective, and you have such a small window to do that. And I find that when I'm talking to a 16-17 year old kid, there's not a whole lot that's being said. You know, most kids are not talking at that point, and if they are, they almost appear to be like outliers. It's almost like it's weird to hear a kid, you know, talk more than their parents. So for me, it's always been the conversations I have with their parents, knowing that at some point that kid's probably going to become just like his father or his mother, you know, and getting to know them. And my staff jokes about it like all the time, like I'll put down an itinerary with timelines and I'll end up sitting here for an hour and a half and 2 hours talking to a family. And they know that if the door is closed for that long, there's a good likelihood that if we like that kid as a player, there's a good chance that we're going to offer that kid an opportunity to be here based on the conversations we have with the parents. The other thing, which I don't think a whole lot of people talk about, is I find it hard to get recruits to commit in the summer, not because they don't want to, but because I don't know if I want them to. Like, I think one of the greatest things we have in our program is our guys being like part of the filtration process of whether this person is going to do well here or not do well here. You know, when you're talking about a sport where we get 2 hours a day with these guys and the other 22 hours, we don't have a whole lot of access to them. Like, you need to make sure they're going to fit in with the guys in your locker room. And you need to make sure they're going to make good decisions when they're not in your presence. So for me, when we get to, you know, September 1 and we can start having guys on campus again, I like that so much more because our guys can be a part of the process. And there's been a lot of guys who've come here that I was like, I love this kid as a player. You know, they kind of pull the wool over your eyes in the office. You know, you're like, oh, this is a great family. I feel really good about this. And then the guys will come back and be like, coach, there's no way this guy can make it here. You know, for this reason or for this reason, like he's not gonna fit into the culture we're trying to build, you know, build on in the culture that's been established for us. You know, so I love hearing the guys' thoughts on every recruit, and I'll text them and then sit them in the office after kids have visited and just be like, what do you think? You know, what are your thoughts on this guy? And again, I want those guys to have as many touch points possible. So they're not just meeting with me. They're doing, you know, conversations with Coach Kenny, maybe Coach Logan and Jack Cook are taking them around campus, you know, with Coach Shakey being here. There's an element where they're meeting with them as well. But yeah, for us, you keep talking about relationships, but it's the truth with me too, man. I love knowing who the parents are. I love laying out kind of the best and worst of what freshman to senior year is going to look like and make it less about the sell and more about like, this is who we are. We're real, you know, we're authentic, and this is what you're going to get when you're here.
So on the last podcast, I asked Andy Shea any advice for kids making their highlight video right now. And my question for you on the basis of what you just said is, any advice for parents who are going to accompany their kid on a campus visit in terms of, I don't know. It's a tough question because, you know, you don't want to tell somebody the things that turn you off immediately. And then now they're equipped with information to artificially avoid, like tamping down their personality and everything else that goes along with that. But with that being said, any advice for parents on how to conduct themselves on a campus visit?
I think it's two-part, man. I think it's the parents just being real and authentic and coming prepared and asking questions and making sure the kids are doing that too. I've been turned off by kids who like sigh, eye roll, like do things when their parents are talking or like almost pretend like they don't have a relationship with their parents. And we had a kid in here a couple of weeks ago and you could just tell like the family like loved each other, man. They were just like really good people. And, you know, the kid's like nodding when his mom's talking and, you know, the dad's talking and the kid's like laughing at what the dad's saying. And it was just like, it just felt right. You know what I mean? You're like, you know, you're never going to have any problems with those people. You know, it's the parents after doing this for 24 years, you build up a pretty good radar for like what's going to work and what's not, you know? And I think a lot of times you go with kind of what was familiar to you growing up. And for me, you know, I have this family dynamic that was large Irish Catholic family, you know, not afraid to be loud, you know, maybe interrupt each other, you know, not afraid to cut on each other, bust on each other every once in a while. But everything was coming from a place of like complete and utter authenticity. And you can tell that. What I don't like is, you know, and I see this a lot with my son and my daughters with youth sports is sometimes like the parents almost appear to be more competitive than the kids in terms of what they want. And it comes off as like desperation. And you definitely don't want to appear to be desperate when you're in here meeting with myself or probably any other coach in the country. You know, you want to make sure you understand your kid's there for a reason. He's really good. And you just got to be yourself. I mean, you know, it's very easy for people that are in the in the business of recruiting people to understand who's real and who's fake. And I mean, it's, I don't know how much else to answer that question, but hopefully that makes sense.
It does. And it's a great note to end on. John Torpy, really, really appreciate your time on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Best of luck as you get your team back on campus. You get the opportunity to host some 24s and start having conversations with some 25s. Can't wait to check out the Panthers in the fall and then see you guys take the field again in the spring.
Thanks, Terry. Appreciate it, man.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.